The scripture today can be found in Matthew 5, 21 through 37. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment." But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, "You fool," you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly and with your accuser while you are on the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in your heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. It was also said, "Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce." But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, "You shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord." But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. May the Lord bless the reading of his word.
Scripture this morning is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 1 through 9. This is Paul speaking to the church at Corinth. "And so, brothers and sisters, I could not speak to you as spiritual people, but rather as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you are not ready for solid food. Even now you're still not ready, for you're still of the flesh. For as long as there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving according to human inclinations? For when one says, 'I belong to Paul,' and another, 'I belong to Apollos,' are you not merely human? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants with whom you came to believe, as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. The one who plants and the one who waters have a common purpose, and each will receive wages according to the labor of each. For we are God's servants, working together. You are God's field, God's building." May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. If all you've ever known about the church in Corinth is the delightful passages that Paul wrote to them, you might think things are pretty good there, but actually quite the opposite. The church at Corinth was like a train wreck of churches. It was a church where conflict was everywhere, and all of the eloquent, beautiful words that came out of that Paul wrote down for them are designed to be an antidote to the problems that he sees in that church. And so it's interesting. You have a bad church, you have a lot of problems, and from that comes some of the best Christian literature ever written. You find this read at weddings, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Everybody sees that and hears that. People have written songs about it. And you have a lesser known passage, but still just as significant, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, which talks about spiritual gifts that we have and how that works within the church. This is profound literature, and he's just trying to use that literature to nourish them. But he says they're really not ready for the good stuff yet. These people are still fighting and quarreling over nothing. As I said in a previous sermon 2 weeks ago, why do people in churches fight? It's because it means nothing at all, for no good reason. This is what happens within churches, and yet here we are. This is how churches behave. I have been in churches. I have been in fights. I have seen this firsthand and experienced it firsthand. And Paul is just saying, get somewhere where you can get together and get on the same page, and then suddenly God's people working together, incredible things can happen. Corinth lent itself to division. It was the most diverse city probably in the Roman world, or one of the most diverse cities. It had Romans. It had Greeks. It had people from what they would call the Orient, the East, there, all gathered together, different cultures, very different cultures, people that didn't look like each other, didn't believe like each other. And they also had a temple to Aphrodite there. Aphrodite was the goddess of lust, or we would say the Greek word was eros, which is kind of like that physical lust and attraction between two people. And that temple was staffed with 1,000 what we'd have to call temple prostitutes. And it was thought as part of their worship, they could just go up there and have sex with a prostitute, and that was somehow a worshipful experience for people. This is how morally depraved the people at Corinth were. And along comes Paul preaching a different kind of morality, offering a different antidote for how to be happy, a different way to live. And not many people subscribed at first. It was kind of a shock. If you're taught that something that you're doing is good, and then suddenly somebody comes and turns on the lights and lets you realize that it's been bad all along, that it hasn't been good for you or anybody, you know, it's a hard adjustment to make for people. And yet in this context, he was able to create converts. He was able to create believers. Perhaps they'd seen enough or had done enough. Perhaps they realized how vacuous their lives were, and they needed something to hold on to love, to be a community, to be together. And yet, in this environment of diversity, they found ways to fight. They were kind of used to fighting. It might have just kind of been in their DNA after centuries of this. And so he's telling them, you just haven't graduated yet. You're still acting like a bunch of kids here. And he's very frustrated with them. And he wanted to offer an alternative vision where instead of each of us trying to fulfill ourselves by winning from our agenda and having victory over others, why don't we all try to work together and watch what can happen? Christians fall into this even today. I remember a conversation with a guy about evangelism, about leading people to Christ. It's an important work of the church. It really is, and on an individual level and collectively. And this guy said, you know, when I go to talk to somebody, I've got an agenda. I've got a plan. I'm going to try to lead that person to Christ. When I go in there to talk to that person about Jesus Christ, I want to hit a home run. I want to lead them to Christ and change their life and turn them around in one conversation. And I was with a group that heard that, and we all thought, you know, that's not how it works. That's not how it works at all. It's not how it worked for me. It's not how it works maybe for you and for others. So I'm sure you can tell stories about this one person that was led to Christ by one other person in just one conversation where the person gave a home run. But that's not even how baseball works. Pitchers and catchers reported last week They're just a part of the team, aren't they? You need good pitching. You need a good offense and a good defense. You need people to hit singles to move the runners along the bases. You need coaches to make good decisions about whether the runner should go forward or stay put. You need people to make decisions about things like sacrifices and bunts and certain situations. How far should the outfield be out there? When should they come in a little closer? Where should everybody be positioned? And you need somebody to help guide that. And they work as a team to advance runners around the bases. And the home run hitter, although they get tremendous glory, I mean, typically, when you have a team that's just got a bomber or two, somebody that hits a lot of home runs, it doesn't necessarily translate into wins for the team, unless the rest of the team is working together on board with the home run hitter. You know, you need everything. You need everybody. It's how it works in baseball. So my friend's idea of hitting a home run, that's not how Christians get made. Christians get made when they're shown love, sometimes by small degrees, just a nice word here and there, a favor, a pie, some cookies, an expression of sympathy when they're going through some trouble. And suddenly they come to church. Maybe they hear a good sermon, or maybe they just saw something on TV that stirs something in them, a desire for Christ. Maybe they talk to somebody who is a Christian and they develop a relationship and a friendship with them. And this can be a very organic and very often slow process that leads a person from not believing to believing. And when you count up all the people that are involved in making it happen, it can be like bigger than a baseball team. The home run hitters are very rare. Baseball works as a team. And if you're the Houston Astros, you steal signals, and that helps you. Sorry, I just threw that one in for free. If I was in Houston, you'd have a meeting after church. Sad thing about the church at Corinth is they didn't make it. As far as anybody knows, they didn't last. They're not still there. The city suffered a decline as trade routes changed and things like that. It deteriorated. You'd like to think that a church gets started by Paul, such a luminary of Christian faith, would keep going. But at some point, this church died. And no one knows the circumstances about how it happened, what caused it. But it's kind of sad. You think that the church that developed this great literature that Paul wrote about, why didn't it lead to a great church? Where were they missing? What did they miss along the way? And we'll never know. But I think maybe this passage gives us a clue. Maybe they never lost their taste for fighting. Maybe they never got tired of tearing each other apart. Maybe they could not do as Jesus compelled them to do in the passage that Annette read this morning. You know, talking about, you know, giving it up if it's not working for you, if it's making you sin. You know, he uses very literal, graphic terms, you know, cutting off your arm if it causes you to sin. Obviously, this is not a literal declaration, or else I would be looking out at a congregation full of amputees this morning. I would be amputated myself. No, he was talking about getting rid of stuff that makes you miserable, that makes you sin, that makes you do bad things. Just let it go. And these people needed to let go of this idea that it was something special that they were led to Christ by Paul or by Apollos. They needed to stop this idea of thinking there's a distinction between us and just drop it. Forget about it. This is worth absolutely nothing, as is the case with almost every church conflict in history. It's not worth anything. They need to drop it and start working together. When Christians develop harmony and start working together, all kinds of incredible things happen. The Spirit is like gas that hits the burner and good things can happen. You get warmth. You can cook with it. You can do something with it. I can think of just a few models where Christianity led to something great. You know, Christian philosophies or philosophers that were Christians developed ideas that eventually became some of the founding principles of our democracy, of our republic, just kind of created that. Some of those philosophers had Christian moorings underneath and underpinnings, and so they talked about things, and they were concepts like justice and equality of all people. Those kinds of things come out of Christianity or were helped by Christianity. But you talk about in actual movements, actual historical movements. You can talk about the abolitionist movement that happened right here and affected this church, the Underground Railroad, the idea of harboring fugitive slaves. These things came through Christianity, people working together. This didn't happen just in the Baptist churches, by the way. This was all denominations, all Christian denominations, at once getting the idea that it was wrong to enslave another human being and deciding they were going to do something about it, and they're going to put all their differences aside. They were just going to cut off those arms and legs that were causing them to sin, and they're saying, I don't care whether you're a Methodist or a Baptist or a Presbyterian or Episcopalian or whatever you are, we're going to drop all that, and we're going to get together and work on a common purpose, a common goal, and that's ending slavery, human slavery. It's wrong. And I know the consequences were tumultuous for our country, and I think we're still fighting the battles now in so many ways. But at least, you know, and I know that there's a human trafficking problem that's huge in this country that needs to be dealt with. Christians might need to get together again and drop all the distinctions that separate us and say we've got to solve this problem. In history, we had the Prohibition movement, and I know you think of that as a failed movement. It was. It's a law that's unenforceable. That's the reason it could never happen. You could never ban all alcohol, because you can make your own. You can do things to get around the law, and there's just not enough policemen in the world to ever enforce a law such as that. But it did cause an awareness of how dangerous the saloon movement was, how dangerous whiskey bars were, the dangers of strong drink, the problems that it could create. And it was in this context that during this time period, during Prohibition, that groups like Alcoholics Anonymous came into being. Actually, Carl Jung had a role in creating Alcoholics Anonymous. In the early 1930s, a well-to-do Rhode Islander, Roland H., that they don't use the last names, he visited Carl Jung, probably in Switzerland, for help with his alcoholism. And Jung said that it was medically hopeless. You can't be cured by something we do as a psychiatrist or as a medical doctor. And he sent him to this group called the Oxford Group, which practiced self-improvement by doing a self-inventory, admitting wrongs, making amends, prayer and meditation, and then sharing the good news with others. And that Oxford movement led to the Alcoholics Anonymous movement, you know, and so that happened in the context of Prohibition. I wonder if these people would have even considered, if we hadn't had a movement of Prohibition, that there was something wrong with what they were doing and what they were going through. And so, yes, I know it was a failed movement, but maybe it wasn't all bad. Maybe it wasn't all for naught. 40 years later, we had the Civil Rights Movement. That would be the last great achievement of Christians working together. At this point, it was, you know, the figurehead, the person on top of this was Martin Luther King Jr., and he was a clergyman. And ministers from many different denominations marched with him, joined with him in trying to eliminate those evil Jim Crow laws, things that kept people from being able to vote, with ridiculous restrictions and barriers that kept people from their full equality of opportunity, denying them their sacred right as Americans to have their own way to make it, their own way to have opportunity. Although he was a Baptist clergyman, and as a matter of fact, he applied at Colgate Rochester Divinity School. He was turned down. They kept his application materials, though. That's interesting. I didn't know they kept such things for people that they turned down. He ended up going to Crozier Theological Seminary near Philadelphia. And then later, Crozier merged with Colgate Rochester, and so now he's back in the Colgate Rochester family. He was a Baptist. In fact, he was convinced by the head of the Baptist Church, the general secretary of the American Baptist Churches USA, to join M&M, Ministers and Missionaries Benefit Board, which is the same board that we raised money for in December. We had a very successful offering in this church to help the retired ministers and missionaries, and he signed up with it about 5 years before he died. And Coretta Scott King, his widow, received a check from M&M until her death in 2006, every month, because of that ministry. Oh, he was a Baptist, and so many of his ideas and principles are aligned with ours as Baptists. And yet, he didn't create a Baptist movement. This is even bigger than a Christian movement. He created a movement that affected people that were secular, that appealed to people that were of other faiths. Everybody started to see how right it was to eliminate these bad laws. And then he took the risk of coming up to places like Chicago and showing them that racism wasn't just the domain of the South. It's also up in the North. We're racist up here, too. There's racism running through our hearts in Western New York, when we think we're better than those places in the South. But either way, it starts with Christians working together. People who just said, let's drop all our denominational distinctions. Let's drop all the things that separate us from each other, and let's move on and get together and do something. Yesterday, I saw a sample of that. I saw all of us down in the fellowship hall working together. And you heard the numbers, you heard the particulars, and I saw everybody working, serving, cooking, preparing, running the breakfast. 88 people received a breakfast of approximately $583, I think, is going to refugees, helping refugees. I'm not sure about the math of all that. Either way, we're going to go help somebody with it. We just put every potential difference aside and just work together and helped. Because when Christians work together, stuff happens. Think about what you could do next. Think about what you are capable of doing when we put all of our differences aside. Unfortunately for the people at Corinth, despite the rich letter that was written to them, they apparently didn't figure it out. But I think there's lots of hope and promise for us. I think we can figure it out. I think that we know how to work together and to make it happen as God leads us. I encourage you, whatever it is that tears you apart from other people, and believe me, I'm familiar with conflict in my own life, cut it off. Drop it. Get rid of it. Start letting yourselves be nourished by the solid food of Jesus Christ and his love for you and his love for others, because great things can happen when Christians work together.